Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your wisdom and guidance upon us. Please bless us today, that we keep our ears and our eyes open to your way and your truth. We learn from you and apply it to our lives. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. We are in 1 Kings chapter 3. This is where Solomon's wisdom starts creating a stir amongst the people, how wise God has made him. But he has to get wise first. So, 1 Kings chapter 3.
Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people were sacrificing at the high places, however, because no house had been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David, his father. Only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings at that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant, David my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept him for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go in or come out. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to govern this your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, "Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. And if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." And Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Then he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, "O my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. And she arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. When I arose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born." But the other woman said, "No, the living child is mine, and the dead child is yours." The first said, "No, the dead child is yours, and the living child is mine." Then the king said, "The one says, 'This is my son that is alive,' and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead, and my son is the living one. And the king said, bring me a sword. So a sword was brought before the king. And the king said, divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other. Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, oh, my lord, give her the living child, and by no means put him to death. But the other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him. Then the king answered and said, give the living child to the first woman, and by no means put him to death. She is his mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to do justice.
Thank you. That was 1 Kings chapter 3. Regarding this particular chapter, it's a very famous one. Most of have read it or heard of it many times. Any questions or comments that comes to mind regarding it? Things that caught your attention you'd like to have answered, if possible? Or anything that you wish to add to or subtract to it? You're welcome to share. As you know, Solomon is relatively young at this point. It even says he's a child. Well, child's relative. We don't know his exact age. You know, he's somewhere between the age of 12 and 20. We don't know the exact number. He became king between the age of 12 and 20. This chapter here is written what appears to be possibly a few years, or maybe within a year or two, after he becomes king. So he's still relatively young. His exact age is still, however, not known. Anything caught your eye? Anything you're curious about what's going on here? Well, one thing that caught my eye was it says God will make him wise, of course, and he was wiser than anybody before or after. So question, was he wiser than Moses? Was he wiser than Messiah? It's bizarre, isn't it? Wait.
I think the first would have been king.
Messiah's a king?
Yeah.
Is he wiser than Messiah will be? Because he says, no one after you, before or after. Messiah's supposed to be king, whether he be now or later. Is Solomon supposed to be wiser than Messiah? 700 wise? Yeah, it's not wise, that's true. But then again, how many wives does Messiah have? Well, okay, one, the church, but how is that comprised of? Lots and lots and lots of people. So I don't know, that's kind of bizarre. I don't know how wise he was on that negotiation of that one either. It's an interesting question. That should have caught your attention immediately. So wait a minute, did God promise something to a flesh and blood man greater than his own son? It's counterintuitive, naturally, or why would God do such a thing? But that should catch your attention. We'll talk about that shortly. But anything else catch your eye? Something else that says, well, that's strange. I wonder why that's the case. Well, I have another question for you that probably hopefully you caught your attention. It says Solomon, all of Israel, technically, sacrificed things in high places. Because it says Solomon followed the ways of his father, he sacrificed his sacrifices in high places. And then it gives you an example of sacrificing the thousand or so of the greatest high places in Gibeon. Well, did David sacrifice at Gibeon? Yes, as a matter of fact, he did. Well, okay, now wait a minute. That's strange. If David sacrificed at Gibeon, the highest of the high places, and Solomon sacrificed at Gibeon, the highest of the high places, how is that any different than David? These questions should be brought to you. Hey, what's the details of the story? Why are they in here? What's going on? Well, you have to ask, okay, what is Gibeon? What's so special about it? Why would David and Solomon both go to a high place in Gibeon to sacrifice? What's the reason? Well, what's in Gibeon? The altar, it says here, that Solomon, after he has his vision, goes to Jerusalem before the altar of the Ark of the Covenant. Sorry, for the Ark of the Covenant. Well, if you recall, when Solomon tries to go after Joab and Adonijah in Jerusalem, they run to the altar of God and hold on to the altar. In Jerusalem, they didn't run all the way to some other town. It's right there. It's all in the same city. So clearly there is some altar of some form, whether which type it is, doesn't say, is there in Jerusalem. So what's going on? Well, as it points out to you in the very beginning of it, of this chapter, Solomon marries Pharaoh's daughter, brings her to the city of David, which is a section of what we consider Jerusalem today. And she stays there during he has to finish or build the house of God and his palace. Right? In the wall. The walls around Jerusalem. So he marries this woman. That's where they all live, inside the city of David, or at least in that area. So is the temple of God built in Jerusalem yet? No. Okay. So where is the temple of God? What was that? At the tabernacle. And where is the tabernacle at? Not yet. Not yet, but not yet. It will be, but it's not there yet. I'll give you, I guess. Guess what? It starts with a G and ends with an N. It's called the city of Gibeon. The tabernacle of Moses, the tabernacle that Moses erected, or what's we don't know the state of condition it's in. It's still obviously a fabric building or fabric structure. It's in Gibeon still. Only the Ark of the Covenant and one of the altars, we don't know which one, is in Jerusalem, because David brought it from, I forgot the gentleman's house, the name, down in Judah's territory. He brought it up with all the animals he sacrificed along the way, every five steps or whatever it was. And brought it to Jerusalem. So it's been there. That's the Ark of the Covenant's at. But the tabernacle, where the priests serve, is in Gibeon. So did David go to Gibeon to sacrifice? Well, yeah. Did Solomon? Yeah. Is it the highest of the high places? And better speaking, yes. It's the tabernacle of God. It's there. But the altar is not. The Ark of the Covenant isn't. But the tabernacle is. So all the requirements, all the tasks, the tools needed to do sacrifices are there, not in Jerusalem. How do I know that? Well, 2 Chronicles chapter 1 tells you what's there. It explains a little bit greater detail as far as what's going on. And the 2 Chronicles, it tells you verse 1... Oh, okay. Sorry, verse 3. Chapter 1, verse 3. It says, then Solomon, this is when he becomes king, Solomon and all the congregation went with him to the high place that was at Gibeon, for the tabernacle of meeting of God was there, which Moses, the servant of God of the Lord, had made in the wilderness. But David had brought the ark of the God from Kirjath-Jearim, the place David prepared for it. He had pitched a tent for it at Jerusalem. Oh, that was 2 Chronicles chapter 1. Verse 3 through 3 and 4. Yeah, the covenant is supposed to be there, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be there, but it's not. That's Eli's sons made a mistake. Actually, Eli made a mistake. His sons did too. The whole family screwed that one up. It's a family affair. But anyway, so they all messed that up. The covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, was taken away to Philistine territory. I think it was for 7 months. I don't remember the exact number of months it was. It was there for a few months. And then brought back again. It was stored at one particular, temporarily stored, at a particular area or place. And then all the men died because they opened it. The Jewish men. Even the Philistines weren't dumb enough to open it until the end. So you think that people who knew God's word don't touch me. Yeah, exactly. So something's wrong with this thing. Yeah. Anyway, so they opened it and God killed them all. And they said, okay, we can't handle this. And they brought it to another man's house who was far wiser and kept the door lid on it. Which for 20 years it was there until David brought it back out to Jerusalem. So the Ark of the Covenant's not at the tabernacle. Out of curiosity, you may ask, why would David bring it from Kirjath Jearim to Jerusalem and not bring it to Gibeon, where the tabernacle is? What was the logic there? What's the reason? Why would David do that? Why would David take God out of his house? So he did. He took him out of his house, so to speak. Should have taken him back, right? That's what he should have done? Or should he? Gibeon's close, but it's not right there, though. It still has a little bit of effort, a little bit of travel to go. Oh, well, it's no, not really a trick question, per se. It's just a curiosity. What can you possibly think of? What was David's motive? Do you recall what his motive was? Oh, yes. Yeah, the Philistines had taken it originally, and they got it back. It was sent back with the two calves that were moaning along the way, and they traveled back to Judah's territory. And it was brought to a man's house in Kirjath Jearim. Afraid of it. He respected it, because when he first tried to move it, there was problems, and men died.
When they put it in that man's house, that man was blessed mightily.
Exactly. The abundance of blessing was put on that man's house, even though the tabernacle wasn't at the man's house, was it? The tabernacle was in Gibeon the whole time. But the Ark of the Covenant was at his house. Was God terribly upset? Well, question. Was he terribly upset that his Ark of his seat was in Kirjath Jearim in a guy's house, while the house that he was built for him is in another city further away? Was God angry with that? Well, clearly not. He blessed the man's house abundantly. So, God being separated from his physical house is not that big of a deal. Got it? It's not that big of a deal. If you recall, during the Judges' time, the Ark of the Covenant was pulled out all the time to go to war. He's not in his house, and he went across the Jordan. It was separate.
The tabernacle also being separate.
Right. Well, a lot of things were being moved and being traveled. So being in his house versus out of his house isn't that critical, per se, to God. He's allowed to live anywhere. So in David, when he noticed or saw in Kirjath Jearim, one man being abundantly blessed because the covenant, Ark of Covenant was there in his house, David's logical reason is, wait a minute, why would I move from that guy's house to another city over there where I'm not? I'll move from that guy's house to my town where I am. If he was blessed, thus I'll get blessed. Logical reasoning. It cost a few lives in the process. That was a separate issue for him. He learned from that. So the Ark of the Covenant getting moved or being living in one place to another place, it's not that critical. It's what you do that matters, and how you move it, and what the use of it is. Are you using it for your personal gain, per se? Are you using it to, as a good luck charm? Used supposedly, as Jeff had pointed it out once during a battle? Well, no, none of those things. David used it because he knew something about God. Where was God's house eventually going to be? In Jerusalem. Did David know that? Yes, he did. How did he know that? He wanted to build it. Yep. Right. Solomon was going to build it. Right. David was a man of war. Now, when David started to move this and moved it from Kirjath Jearim to Jerusalem, he moved it there, of course, and placed it in a temporary home or temporary place with it. There were priests assigned to that. There was an altar there. There were certain tasks still done, even though there was no tabernacle of meeting built around it. Well, why didn't he bring the whole tabernacle of meeting with him? Any ideas? Have you ever seen Jerusalem before it was built? Yes. How big of an area is there to build on the city of David's territory? There wasn't. If you ever get a map from map, of course, is relatively speaking, of course. This is based upon excavation and archaeology. But the area of Jerusalem, the city of David, where David was and where the people lived, the physical space required for the tabernacle would consume way too much physical space on that little plateau. It was small. It wasn't until Solomon and his sons later built up the ground and expanded Jerusalem's space before they start building town actually larger to actually accommodate more than, they estimated somewhere around 500 people in Jerusalem initially when David showed up. That's very, very small. You're not going to get 500 people to get in a space, roughly, 500 families, sorry, I should say families, not people, 500 men, they're also roughly, their families, of course, as well. But it's small space, a small town. It wasn't until his sons that he built the town bigger when the house of God gave built, so the tabernacle of meeting, or the temple of God, can actually be structured and God have a permanent home. That doesn't happen yet. Solomon hasn't done it yet. So they are separated. Yes, Ali. It's still small. I believe, if I recall correctly...
5 miles square.
Yeah, it's small.
It is small.
Yeah, I believe I recall correctly, Solomon increased Jerusalem... The estimate, I think that he almost doubled its physical space or size. And then each subsequent king added a little bit more there. Eventually making it, not with the size of its day, but smaller than what it is today. By filling in valleys and filling in crevices and filling in spaces in order to build on it. They slowly built it. It took time. It was a lot of time. Jerusalem was a city on a hill. Why was it such a special city? What was so valuable about it? Why would God want that city versus anybody else? Why would David say, this is his home? No other town is far easier to build in. I like the hill. God did like the hill. What was that? God chose that hill. If you recall, when I just discussed this back at the end of 2 Samuel, God's angel came through and was doing a massive killing of the people of Judah, of Israel, actually. And he stopped at one man's house and stood there. Not because the man was special, not because anything was great about him. God said to the angel, stop. Don't spill blood right here. There's something special about right here. And David saw it in the vision. He saw the angel stopping there and said, okay, God, there's something about this spot that was different than everywhere else in all of Israel. This is where the temple of God was built, at that one spot where the angel stopped. God was not going to allow human blood to be killed on his land. It was just too small. So the king had to build it up. The king's name was Solomon. So Solomon does sacrifices in different areas, just like David and everybody else did. So this example given regarding Solomon going to Gibeon is not to be taken as an example of Solomon sacrificing at any random high place. He did sacrifice at other high places. That's independent of this specific example. Because the logical question would be, if Solomon was sacrificing at some pagan high place, why is God going to come down and say, oh, Solomon, what do you want? Thank you for sacrificing so well. I'll grant you your wishes. Wouldn't that be counterintuitive? If I chose to sacrifice at Mecca, for example, a bunch of animals, whatever, God said, oh, thank you for listening to me. I've come down at Mecca to answer your questions. Would that reaffirm God's authority, or would that reaffirm Mecca? It reaffirmed Mecca. That would make no sense. It's not, this example here, Gibeon, is not to be taken as an example of Solomon sacrificing a random high place, which he does later in his life. We're not talking about that. We're talking about this example here is independent. This example is Solomon actually talking to God, sacrificing to the one and only God at a particular place where God's house was at. Make sense? All right. Hence, God listened. I won't go through all the details, take too much time. 1,000 olah offerings, burnt offerings, if you recall, in Leviticus, what does an olah offering require of the person offering it? Who has to kill it? The man who's offering it, not the priest. So question, do you think Solomon slaughtered 1,000 bulls himself? Is by his own hand? Not likely. Probably people do it. So, it's an awful lot for one man to do, no matter how hard you try. It's both, the priest's not supposed to kill it. The burnt offering, the priest does not kill it. Only the man who's offering it kills it. He then hands it over to the priest, which is separate. So whether he slaughtered it or whether he had his men slaughter, I'm not going to argue that point. 1,000 is an awful lot. We do not know how much time that took, but we do know olah offerings are not eaten. They're completely burned up. No part of it is consumed for food. So did anybody get fed by it? Nope. Pray to God. I don't know how long it took. Could have taken weeks. We do not know how long. So, Solomon has this vision. God asks him, obviously, wisdom, and we won't go through all the details. The vision's pretty self-explanatory. Solomon wakes up, and what's the first thing he does? He goes from Gibeon to Jerusalem, where the Ark of the Covenant is. His wisdom increased. He moved from the house of God to where God actually was in Jerusalem, in verse 15. He moves there, moves course. Now, in verse 15, it discusses that he offered both burnt offerings, which is the same ones he was doing in Gibeon, but he also offered peace offerings, which is different. Peace offerings we consider almost like barbecues. Everybody eats, everybody partakes of it, consumes it up. It's a sharing type of thing for all the people who are around you or near you. And Jerusalem being relatively small in size, he probably shared with most of the town. Any questions so far? It's pretty self-explanatory. The story is pretty basic. It's nothing complex about it. Yes, Ellie.
Well, it's interesting that Solomon, all of the decisions that he makes, there is a child, and on the third day after the birth, the child's dead, but he's alive, which is messianic.
Yes, yes. Those of you who know the general rule, within the entire Bible, if you see the number 3 and death and life associated with that number 3, it is a picture of Messiah. Period. If you don't recognize the picture, look harder. It's there. If you still don't recognize it, pray and look again. It's still there. Every time you see the number 3 and life and death associated with it, it is a picture of Messiah. Why? Because God wants to hammer it into our heads. Messiah, life, death, and number 3 are all combined together. When you see those symbols together, you are talking about the Son of God. So in this particular case, Ellie rightly pointed out, she saw that there was obviously children born, 3 days involved, at least number 3 was 3 days, and of course, one's dead and one's alive and one is spared. Yes, Ellie.
Well, and to me, this is of extreme importance to be able to recognize that, because as I've been reading this week, there are a lot of ideas of another God being the same as our God. And yet there's a mosque on the Temple Mount that says God has no son in Arabic. So if that is their concept, we would have to prove throughout the scriptures that the Messiah is all over it so that we wouldn't fall for that.
Right, right. We have a tendency to fall for things rather quickly, actually. I attest to that for myself. So the more often repeated, the better off you are in remembering. So in this particular story, you have two harlots. Now, my Bible translated them to be kind as innkeepers. Realistically, they were most likely harlots. They're prostitutes. Now, the reason my Bible translated as innkeepers for the same reason that Rahab, the harlot slash innkeeper, was translated as innkeeper in some of your Bibles and translated as harlot or prostitute in others. The word innkeeper and prostitute or harlot are one and the same word. Two different meanings, but one and the same word. You determine the difference by context. What's the context about? Is the person an innkeeper, or is the person a harlot? Well, it depends. In Canaanite territory, at the time in Joshua with Rahab, was she a harlot or an innkeeper? I'll leave that up for debate. The point is, men stayed there overnight, whether they rented a room or whether they were using hers, it doesn't matter. That's just the story. In this particular case, harlot's probably more accurate because both women were pregnant and they were both living together with no one else lives in the house. So there's no male, no husband, or anything like that involved. Most likely that occurs from either husband at war, which Solomon was not at war at this time, or there is no husband, period. Most likely a prostitute. So why would God send two prostitutes to Solomon for justice? Why wouldn't he say, wait a minute, you're a sinner worthy of death according to the Torah, and you're a sinner worthy of death according to the Torah, and your children, because of how they came about, are also worthy of death according to the Torah. He could have said, give me my sword, kill them all. Solution. Simple and done, right? Why not? Think about it. You got to think about it. Think about it. So if he doesn't want to use the Torah as an example to create justice according to Moses, what is the example giving us? Mercy. That even though a person is a sinner by every definition, justice is still given. Your case is still heard. He could have said, I'm not going to hear this case. I'm not going to listen to this because you're both worthy of death. But he didn't. It points out, it gives you an example that even though you are a debased and unacceptable person in society, you still get justice. You still get to be heard. That's worth a lot. How many of us are in the same technical category? If we went before God, say, God, I got a problem with Joe Schmo over here. He did something bad to me. And God said, wait a minute. But you're on death row. What does it matter? I said, well, he is too. So, yeah, you both are. So what is it? Why are you even speaking to me? As a matter of fact, your execution is about 10 minutes. Well, what does it matter what the justice is between the two of you? It wouldn't make any sense. It's mercy. It's mercy that God gives. He said, all right, Daniel, I will hear your case. Even though your execution is in 10 minutes, I will hear your case and decide justice between the two of you. That's the example. Obviously, it's an extreme, but that's the whole point. That what your life past is independent of what justice is. Justice is not defined by your history or your actions, per se. Justice is defined of what's fair, what is right, what is a fair outcome. It doesn't matter who you are. Love, justice is mercy. Exactly. Justice is mercy. Okay, so now we're on this case. So he's seeing this particular case, example, of course, of his great wisdom. He tricks, obviously, the women into discussing this issue. But before we go to all the details of how he does it, as Ellie pointed out, yes, there are examples, there's messianic examples inside this story. And so we're going to explore them for a few minutes before I'm going to call it quits, because I don't want to spend too much time on this, simply because I'm out of time today already. So write these down real quick. So she correctly pointed out there's a case of a third day. One child is born. And one's dead. So obviously this is an example of you have a third day showing up. One child dead, one child alive. We have that example. I'm going to spend this just a little bit to example of what I want you to see of the women themselves, not so much the child or the child of her death. So, one woman, she says, no. The son is... with me. I I'm using that terminology, but it's mine, or with it, it belongs to me. And the other one's the exact same phrase. No. And then, let's see here. So they're both claiming this phrase, right? No, the son's mine. No, the son's mine. But the interesting thing I want to point out to you about it is the stuff leading up to it. I'm going to erase my question up here because it's in the way. So forgive me. So obviously we're talking about Messiah. I'm going to sit there and point out the obvious. All right. But leading up to those phrases is this. Harlot kills her son. A harlot does not recognize her son. A harlot buries or conceals or puts inside of the other woman's clothing or hides it, conceals it. I'm using the term purposefully, buries. I never spell buries right, so forgive me. B-U-R-I-E-S, whatever. It makes the difference. You get the point. He's vindicated. buries her son. Let's see here. And see. Harlot spares her son. Now, I'm using these phrases and purpose. I'm not telling you which harlot's which. You can always look at the various phrases. One, her harlot kills her son. Who killed Messiah? Jews. Ah, so question. Who's the harlot? Think about that. A harlot does not recognize her son. Who did not recognize Messiah? Oh, who's the harlot? Ah, think about that for a minute. A harlot buries her son. Who buried Messiah? Think about this one. Who buried him? Who buried him? Who buried him? Say it a little louder. No. The Christians, what followers of him. His followers buried him. So think, who's the harlot? Ah, made you think a little bit harder that one, didn't you? So a harlot spares her son. Who spared Messiah? God. That's strange. Who actually spared the son? Was it the woman or was it Solomon? Ah, that's better. It was the harlot. Put your mind in God's mind for a minute. What do these people look like? They're his wives. God married them. They're all part of Israel. Are they not? Are they not all part of Israel? Yes or no? Yes. What did God say in the story of Gomer? What's the story of Gomer about? A harlot. Right. What did God say about his people, Israel? They never stay at home. What are they doing? They're being harlots. So what does God say about us? What's the example? Whether you believe in Messiah, meaning sparing him, following him, just as the Christians did, or whether you don't, what are you? You're still a harlot. You're still unclean. You're still unacceptable. You're still intolerable. But what does he still grant you? Mercy and justice is still granted to you. to grant to all of us. Make sense? It's simple. It's a very simple imagery. That's the point. He's using the story of harlots. And by the way, I use the term Solomon for harlot. If you recall, how many wives and concubines did he have? Yeah. Would that constitute him as being a harlot? I mean, for example, how many husbands, use quote, does a harlot have? It could be hundreds. Who knows? How many men does she known by? Oh, quite a few. How many women is he known by? Quite a few. So is he a harlot just like she would be? Just because he's a male doesn't make him not a harlot. Switch the genders around, guess what? We call her a prostitute. What do we call a male? I won't discuss that. He's no better than anybody else, okay? So is he a harlot? Well, yes, he is. We already know he's going to be. He already married Pharaoh's daughter. What does that make him? Not exactly acceptable. Because according to the Torah, if you marry somebody outside of Israel, you are not allowed to have that child from the marriage enter in the community of Israel until the third generation. Third generation goes by before any child from this marriage would be allowed to enter the community of the congregation of Israel, meaning to worship alongside them within the temple area or temple purposes. So, Solomon's already starting his way quite well on the harlotry side. He's one of the most successful men-women thing, whatever you call it, about it. So, calling him a harlot is not necessarily wrong. He is. He really is. So, no matter who you are, no matter how wise Solomon is, or whether you believe in Messiah or not, as far as God's eye is concerned, you're still a harlot. You still have done things and do not stay at home where you belong. In spite of that, I will hear your case and grant you justice. That's a beautiful story. How wise was Solomon? Was he wiser than Messiah? Was he wiser than Moses? Well, we're not saying how he may be wiser in one fashion or another. It says in the next chapter, I believe, he is the wisest of all things in creation, meaning the world around him. Maybe he was. Maybe he did. We don't know. It points out that he's wiser in the world around him. So his observational wisdom is superior to all in the form of nature, plants, animals, nature, human beings, what they think and how they think and why they think the way they do and why they act the way they do. Is that greater than Messiah? Should not be. Because I have a question for you, which this should answer the question whether he was wiser than Moses or wiser than Messiah or not. How many witnesses were in this story? Right. How many witnesses did it take to make confirm or deny a matter? Two or three. But these two witnesses were counteracting one another. So you only have one witness. We don't know which one's right. Can you determine what is right with one witness? No. But he did. I have another question for you. John chapter 8. When the woman was brought before the Pharisees, and they told him she was caught in the act, what do you say? We know Moses says to stoner, what do you say? And what does he say? He writes the thing on the ground. We don't know what it is. What does he say? He who cast the first stone. Yeah, cast the first stone, right. And did anyone cast a stone? They all left. Why? Did Messiah know she was guilty?
Yeah.
Knew them. Did he know her? Yeah, because he tells her then, go and stop sinning. End your sinning. So he was able to make a decision with not even one witness. Messiah did it. It didn't even require a single witness. Right. So, is he wiser than Solomon? Yep. Solomon at least required a witness and had to trick them to figure out what was telling the truth or not. Messiah knew it already. You know, at least obvious, of course, it was a simple rhetorical question. It was Solomon wiser than Messiah? No, he is not. Messiah is the Son of God. Solomon, of course, is not. Is Solomon wise in everything that is relevant to what's going on in his life and existence? Yes, he is. In all the various kings and nations around him, is he wise in all of them, will be or have been? Yes. That's independent of what Messiah was, how wise Messiah was. Wiser than his father. If you recall, David had a similar problem with Ziba and Mephibosheth. He could not tell who was telling the truth and who was lying. They both came witness to their case. And he said, all right, just split the land between both of you. One of you is lying, I don't know which one it is. Mephibosheth tells him, don't split the land. Keep it all and just give it to Ziba. But David did not realize at that moment in time, Mephibosheth was the true non-liar, the one who was telling the truth. In that story, hence we have this story. So that story that David's there with the same problem, two men, one's lying, one's not, and David doesn't know what's right, he divides the land in half. The truthful one says, no, keep the land the same, just give it to him. And David did not make the judgment call that Solomon did. Ah, thus means the land is actually belongs to the truthful one. So Solomon is wiser than his father David. Solomon is not wiser than Messiah. He still had to have a witness. Because the Pharisees were not actually witnesses against the prostitute. They weren't.
I'm mad at you. When I first read it, I thought the moral was, God's saying, if you're a harlot, I will smite you with my smiting stick, and then I will spare your son.
Well, you could argue that could be a good moral, and that's actually a good thing to think about. If you're a harlot, you might get smitten with the smite stick. Lean on the button for a while. Oh, yeah, I've been smitten enough, God. But maybe. Well, that may be an additional lesson to be learned by it. But that's a separate thing than what I wish to discuss today. This makes sense. Makes it a little more detail of what the story is actually telling you, not just the surface, but actually deeper symbolic meaning. Because when you're reading the stories, they're written in the Bible, they're not just stories. They're deep lessons, spiritual lessons to learn from. So learn the spiritual lesson. Am I a harlot? According to God, yes. Are you? According to God, yes. Is everybody? According to God, yes. Do we all still get our case heard before him? According to God, yes. That's mercy. That's kindness. Whether I'm on death row or not, he still hears my case. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
The high places.
Yes.
What differentiates, here it sounds like a negative, only, he walked in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed made offerings at the high places. And then we have all the rest of the kings of Judah that still sacrificed in the high places until Hezekiah. So, the high place is not good, right?
In itself, high places is not good. Because the high places are used not in the fashion that God desires or wishes to be honored or worshipped. Now, in the case of Solomon, this particular high place listed in Gibeon is not just an ordinary high place. It is where God's house is. It is a unique category of high places. All of Israel did high places. It doesn't make them right. High places are not good things. They're not. Does God wish to be separate from his Ark of the Covenant in a town in Gibeon? Or does he want his house separate? Is that his desire? No. He has two different places. One's in Jerusalem and one's in Gibeon. He would like them to be together in his home, known as the temple that Solomon's about to build. But until that happens, it's divided up. The high place in Gibeon, when the tabernacle is removed, does it remain a high place? No. Now, question. A high place in, let's say, for example, the hill country of Ephraim, where God never was. If God's in the temple, is that high place in the hill country of Ephraim a high place still? According to the people of Ephraim, yes. That's the distinction. When a high place is God's, God put himself there.
That's the high
place. Yeah. When a high place isn't God's, and you're still going there to worship, And he said, I'm not there, but you're going anywhere? That's not a high place anymore. You're doing something contrary to his will. That's the distinction. When you're doing something according to what God told you to do, and this is the only method you have to do it because this is where he's living, you do it according to his way. That is the high place. And that's an acceptable task. When God's no longer there, it's now I have this rule book, follow the rules. You say, oh, thanks to the rule book, I set it down, I'll walk around, I want to do my own rules over here on this place because it looks nicer. Maybe it's maybe better rain, who knows. It looks nicer, better place, looks maybe in nice rock formations, whatever the reason is. I like this spot over here because you're just kind of too hot and maybe it's just too many people around. Is that according to God's rule? No, it's not. He gave the rule book. He put a house. This is the rule book called the temple. Obey the rules according to the way they're written. Make sense? There's a distinction between just any high place and what God's actually asking for. Now, Solomon later on in his life, actually a couple chapters down before we'll probably read about it, he offers incense and he offers things in the non-temple, non-tabernacle of God locations. That's wrong. That's going contrary to God's will. Jezebel, I believe, does it as well as Ahab and, of course, all of their children and grandchildren.
So this happens to be a high place that was made only
because
the tabernacle
was
there.
Right.
But most of these high places
are
they
not.
They had Asherah poles and
right.
Were
exactly.
Other gods.
Right, exactly. Most high places were not, is not where the tabernacle of God is.
It's like with Moses and the burning bush. That was not a high place. Because God is there.
Take
yeah,
off your shoes. This, I am here. You know, don't pollute my gland. You know. But once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, the place is no longer a high place anymore. It's just it's a historical monument, essentially. But if the bush was still around. It is. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. A worship of something that is typically evil. This is an example in Gibeon, the only example I know of, where it's not. It's a separate category because God's actually there. Jerusalem used to be a high place, meaning for pagan usages. But it wasn't once God put his house there, he cleaned it up. It's now his. They took over a existing spot. Now, I'm not saying the temple of God is actually at the physical spot where a high place event happened. That's not what I'm saying. The area of Jerusalem itself contained high places within it when David showed up and obviously all the other people showed up to take over and use it for God's purposes. So high places are high, meaning that they are for pagan usages until God says, I'm cleaning this up now and it's done. He cleans it up, it's cleaned up, it's gone.
Place that was holy then was Gibeon.
Yes, until the tabernacle was moved,
and
it was Gibeon.
And it says that he made offerings at high places, plural,
yes.
So he was in error.
Right. He did other high places independent of this
okay.
one. Right. There's multiple places he goes to. If you continue reading 1 Kings and the 2 Kings, or the 1 Kings, you'll read a few of the spots where he also did other things he should not have done at different locations. There's a few of them.